Hi, welcome to the NDA podcast. My name is Justin Pierce and I'm the editor. This podcast is one in our series called NDA Meets, where we get a chance to sit down and chat to some of the most interesting people across our industry. And today I am personally hugely excited to sit down and chat to Brian Morrissey. He's currently the founder of The Rebooting, but he was not so long ago the president and editor-in-chief of DigiDay. So let's see what he's got to say about the world of publishing today. So, Brian, hi, good to see you.
Good to see you, Justin. It's been a little while. We worked together very briefly. Everyone should know this, full disclosure.
Far too briefly.
Yeah, well, you left.
DigiDay, which I was
talking. You didn't expect this to get hostile, did you?
Everyone knows. Well, I left to set up my own business, but sadly, I've always got a huge amount of love for DigiDay and the people there. I love it. I love the company. And let's start off, I guess, with DigiDay. Everyone knows you for many different reasons, but I think for a lot of people, myself included, you kind of were DigiDay and I still are to an extent. So do you want to talk a little bit about why you left and why you set up Rebooting? What that now is.
Yeah, I mean, it had been almost like 10 years. I didn't get to the 10-year. I don't know what happens at 10-year if you get like a watch or something like that. But I had joined DigiDay, and I had been the digital editor back when they had such a thing at Adweek. And I really was impressed by what, Nick was doing with, on the event side. And I just saw, the model of old trade publications relying on those congratulatory ads. I'm like, there is no economic value in this. Like, I mean, there's limited economic value, but like, I didn't see that as a really compelling model. And so I really like the events model. I'm really like proud of what we did there. I think we, didn't execute everything great, but we're able to grow the company to the point where I think it was one of the, probably the leaders of that field. Yeah, everything like runs its course. So at the end of the day, like my time there, was great and everything like that. But I feel like anytime you stay at one job for like a super long time, particularly these days, like you kind of, I don't want to say you start to coast, but you sort of get a little bit, I don't know, you kind of go on a little bit of like autopilot. Like everything becomes, there used to be this like Dunkin' Donuts commercial, like back when I was growing up, where this guy would just like wake up at 4 a.m. It's baker and he was like, time to make the donuts. And he would like sleepwalk through making the donuts. And I think that's a risk for anyone who stays at a job for a long time. So yeah, I left during the pandemic, super pandemic thing. I'd moved to Miami and left and spent some time wandering and figuring out what I wanted to do. But I knew that I wanted to build something of my own, at the end of the day. I think when you don't found something, I didn't found DigiDay. It's funny because like people, a lot of times people thought I did, but I didn't. Yeah, and there's a lot of advantages to being the founder, turns out. I knew I wanted to start something and just my favorite times, I think, were when it was small and building from scratch and it doesn't get smaller or more scratch than going from zero. So, I mean, as you know, right? It's rewarding.
I do. So what is the Rebooting? I mean, people that don't know, yeah. I guess most people do know.
Well, I mean, the mission of it, I really think that it's important to build a sustainable, equitable, and resilient media ecosystem. And both from like covering it for 2 decades, but frankly, living in it. My first job, the magazine went under. I got laid off before it went under. So it's like, welcome to the industry. You've been laid off. I don't think that's normal in a lot of fields. I don't think accountants like they go to their first job and then like after a year, it's like common just to get like, whacked one day. You go into work and then next thing you know, you're at Rudy's in Hell's Kitchen where they serve free hot dogs. I highly recommend it if you're ever in New York and get laid off, go to Rudy's. But that's how the industry is. And like I just see a lot of misplaced incentives across the industry. And I think at our best at DigiDay, we were very like, we gave an unvarnished view that was less common at that point. I think it's more common now. But I just sort of wanted to have a property that was about conversation first and foremost, because I think that's how you get at productive solutions about how do you build this sustainable, equitable, and resilient media ecosystem. And I started focusing on publishers because that's sort of where my expertise and interests lie, but also because I think that is where the part of the media ecosystem is sickest. With we talk about all kinds of different things about data and all this. Without the people creating content, all of this falls apart. I just believe that. And it is the part that is the most challenged. Everyone goes and starts with the marketer. And I'm sorry, they do it for one reason, because that's where the money starts. And that's why there's 16 different marketers' halls of fame and like marketers to watch, brave marketers of the year, 15 CMOs to watch, you know, all of that kind of stuff, the CMO councils and whatnot. I don't know. If you're a CMO, I think you could just go around just being like praised like all day. And it is, I hate to break it to my CMO friends, but it's because you have budgets.
Open secret. But what about, I mean, B2B trade publishing, which we are both always happy. I mean, is the business model itself sustainable, a B2B trade publication in its kind of traditional, even though that's now digital form?
If you look at the broader trends in media, B2B is one of the more protected and resilient parts of it. It was funny because I would be talking with people, but then I was president of Digita. I was trying to operate the business. I didn't do the sales part, but I built the membership. My teams built the membership, product, design, you know, and trying to figure out a business model. But the kinds of conversations I was having with the scale digital media players were totally different than the conversations we had. We never thought about, I didn't care about unique visitors, or the pivot to video was not really much of a consideration because it just makes no sense. And I think a lot of the directions that the media industry is going, more niche, more specialized, more direct connections, less reliance on advertising necessarily. And when there is a reliance on advertising, it's a particular type of advertising that you don't compete with platforms in. In-person activations, events, whatever you want to call them. I mean, all these things are hallmarks of B2B. B2B is very good because unlike most areas of media, like the mechanics are still the same. You can still run, for all the grief that like quote unquote traditional B2B gets, you can still basically run the same playbook. You just need to tweak it a little bit. And that's not the case pretty much in any other form of publishing and media. So I think B2B is incredibly well positioned. And I think that's why you see the resilience of a lot of these brands whose products are frankly not that great.
Let's talk a little bit about innovation and business models, I guess, particularly in that sector. You know, when I worked with you, I came to DigiData to sort of work on the content marketing side of the business. I was doing that before my previous job.
I know, but then you left, Justin.
I did leave, but then I left to set up my own business, which Nick was very gracious about, even though I'd only been through 3 months. It's been in my heart. DigiData is always in my heart. But
really,
but this is
I don't know. We had wanted posters of you up all around the office. That's strange. Have you seen this man?
Yeah. But look, I was listening to your podcast recently with The Whistle, I don't know that much about, but talking about the kind of the agency model within a publisher, and a publisher with an agency model, an agency publisher. And Blue Shark Group itself, you know, we started as a PR and content agency and then launched a publication off the back of it.
Yeah.
And we're doing really well. It's a very weird...
No, I love it. I love like the sort of reverse, you know, twists of models. And I think that's a great example of like taking the model and just turning it on its head. I mean, usually like during your all too brief time at Digiday, we had a content studio, and that really started because I remember being at one of our events and I was talking to someone afterwards and I was like, oh, how do you think it was? And he was like, oh, I think it was really good, except that session by insert company name here sucked. I was like, oh, but that was a sponsored session. And then he was like, I don't care. It wasted my time. And so we started the content studio with the simple idea that people don't get up in the morning and say, I want to suck. And that like we had expertise that we could transfer over to them to make compelling experiences because it was in our interests. But like the reverse is also true. You can start from that side of it and go into the quote unquote editorial side. I'm all for it.
Yeah.
You don't need my endorsement.
Because I mean, we're very proud of it. No one's doing this in B2B in the UK at least. It's very common. Yeah. It's you publishing, but it's not happening B2B.
Although anytime someone says like nobody's doing it, I'm like, but maybe there's a reason.
No. Yes. So like, maybe there is. I mean, it's been really, really tough. And it's things that are new often taken out quickly because it's distrust. Yeah. We can't prove that, but it's not that backable, you know, still making model work. Let's go and talk about some sort of wide things of publishing. Obviously, you talk to everyone in publishing all the time, so you've got a firm grip on sort of what's happening in the market. And as you say, you know, your meeting is dedicated to rebuilding the media business and creating a sustainable media business. So I'm going to pick up a few quotes I heard you say recently. We've talked what they mean. So you're talking about the need to get rid of adversarial business models. What do you mean exactly?
So I think the hardest part of publishing is you're trying to serve different constituencies with different needs, and a lot of times they're in conflict. So running any business involves making trade-offs, right? It just, you have to make trade-offs, and that's the reality of the business, and you have conflicting goals. It's really, really complex in publishing because you're trying to serve the goals of the audience. You're trying to serve the goals of your customers, which are frequently the advertisers, not the audience. And then you also have to serve the needs of the platforms, because the reality is most media companies have lost control of their distribution. And without control of your distribution, you're at the mercy of others all the time. And so there's a reason, for instance, if you go on YouTube, that every thumbnail looks the same with that surprise guy face. You know the surprise guy face. I don't know if you do this on YouTube. You should do, we should do the Justin surprise guy face.
I can do that. That's coming soon.
But like, there's a reason. You have to serve the platform. So there's a reason that the recipes need a jump to recipe button, because like people have to wade through all this crap about the backstory, but they're doing it for the search engines because that's what the search engine wants. So you're trying to serve all these different masters. That's why when you, I mean, it's a very bracing experience. I just want to say for any American that clicks on some link that goes to a UK like local news site, like even for us, like we are hyper-capitalists here. I mean, we love capitalism. We really push it. We really try to push it. But when we get there, oh man, it's coming at you from the top. It's coming at you from the bottom. It's coming at you from the sides. And right when you think you got through, it just keeps coming and coming. I mean, it's like, it's really amazing. That's what I mean by adversarial models.
So you think that's interesting. I mean, I don't spend a huge amount of time reading US publications. I probably should do more. But do you think that's the case, that the ad cluster is just far worse?
Oh my God. Yeah. Because like, the reality is it's a hard market for publishers out there. And the ad market, the digital ad market is in recession. And I think the outstanding question is this secular or cyclical? Is this a secular shift? And I think a lot of times, you know, leadership of a lot of these companies, is, it has to be so short-term focused that they're just thinking quarter to quarter, how do we make fourth quarter? And I think the looming question is, everyone's traffic is down because that's the reality of these platforms. They've lost control of their distribution. And too many of them have not made the pivot or the shift that needs to take place to have protected revenue streams that are not tied to ads on pages, because there are fewer pages. There are more places to put ads. There are more places in which the ads can be better targeted, because publishers are never going to win on who's got more data. Like, who has more data, Instacart or the Washington Post? I mean, the Washington Post missed their numbers by 100 million. I mean, that's a big miss. Big miss. But I think it's more acute. This is my sort of vibes-based analysis of it. I think it's more acute in the UK because it's a smaller market, right? Okay. Like you can be mediocre in a big market and do a lot better than being great in like a small market. That's why we have so many UK publications that are coming to the US market to try to break into it. Because if you're even like number six here, it's a really, really big advertising economy, because it's a giant economy. So I would guess like that would be the case, that because the market is smaller, the pressures are even greater.
You talk about UK publications, I guess, just being full of ads. You can't get away from ads on ads on ads. But at the same
time, I'm attacking like the honor of like what are some of the ones sort of the most aggressive at? Like, I don't know, like a Liverpool set or something like that.
Yeah.
Wow. Daily Mail is, although, you know, the Daily Mail, I find it is one UK publication that has come in and really established itself in the US market. Like, they are real players with a real brand here, and they have real loyalty, you know? And so we often talk about, I talk about like having less adversarial sort of approaches. Their product is so good. And I know people probably don't want to hear it, like, because Daily Mail is kind of different, I feel like, in the UK market, or seen different. Here, it's just a celebrity publication. They deliver on what they promise, and they deliver it really well and consistently. And people put up with a pretty aggressive monetization experience, a lot of monetizable moments, because they want to see the photos. They're different here than they are. It's not political here, so.
No, let's not go into the politics today, because I could tell Ravens it would be a very pleasant conversation. But
I thought we were going to talk about Brexit next.
But you talk about the Daily Mail and publications throwing ads on the page, trying to make some money, desperate money. But a lot of ads. At the same time, you said recently that, your exact words, right, display advertising is a lost cause full of atrocities. So is display advertising dead? But then why is there so
Like, it's very infrequent that you're going to build a media company based around display ads. I find that very strange. So by that, I mean that having that as the main source of business strategy is a lost cause. Like, that, you're not going to do that. Like, I think you can, of course, you can pull it off of your a quote unquote programmatic site. I don't know. The moral panic that, I don't know who is whipping up the moral panic about made for advertising sites, but like, the moral panic over those, yeah, you can like make it work if you're a totally manufactured site that is basically just an SEO or social arbitrage scheme. Like, there's always, like, the internet is always going to be filled with these kinds of arbitrage opportunities. Yeah. But I think for like news publishers, for content publishers who are investing money in creating quote unquote real content, it's hard to see how the math works in a model that is heavily dependent on display ads on web pages that you get people to. I just don't see it.
Just back to that point, why do you sort of describe it as a moral panic around made for advertising sites? Because I'd say it's less moral than commercial, because advertisers, many of whom weren't as aware of these sites as you and I were.
I don't understand what these, I guess it's just because there's such a gradation of what is quote unquote made for advertising. I mean, you could argue that like a lot of Condé Nast is made for advertising. I don't like, I mean, that's the business in some ways. So I think in some ways, it sounds like something that's great to be against. I don't know exactly what it means exactly. And I think maybe it's like, you know, when you see it. And so obviously, I think it's like when you go to the bottom on the content rec networks, those sites, I guess. And I don't know. I mean, I guess it really just depends on what people are buying and if that's what they want and if it truly performs. But I think about like, you know, maybe you shouldn't call, what is it, the pot calling the kettle black? These things are using a lot of the methods that other quote unquote premium publishers use, perhaps not as the core of their model, but like, be careful when you start to cast these kind of moral aspersions, because the spotlight should come back on your practices too. So I'm all for cleaning up the overall ecosystem, whatever. And I think it starts with marketers just taking more responsibility instead of just like taking the Hall of Fame nominations. But at the same time, that's going to require publishers to perhaps look at their own practices, because there's gradations to this. And I think it's usually like, well, they're worse. I'm like, well, okay, that's a interesting positioning.
That's a good point. Many MFA sites often aren't that different from the ones they
have. I mean, a lot of publishers, they have similar type operations. Like, everyone does content that is just for SEO and just to catch search engines. It's very common for advertisers to have different versions of their pages to fulfill ad campaigns through content rec ad networks and to load them down with a very intrusive ad experience that people wouldn't get on their regular site. So I don't know. I mean, it seems like there's a lot of the practices are going all around. So I think to me, it's hard with the categorization because there's so many gradations. I think it would be better to really target. I think you have to target on almost like a unit economics basis, specific instances, because from what I understand of what MFAs are, the practices are more widespread than just this category of website, which I don't even understand what the categorization is.
Well, I think it's happening.
It seems very vague. I mean, it seems like the pornography thing. It's like, you know, when you say it, I guess.
Yeah, I think you're right. It's an interesting area. But let me just, last question I always put to you, because I can't think it sort of sums up everything Rebutin's about and everything you do, I guess, is that digital publishing has been looking for a savior so long. Is digital publishing still looking for a savior? Will it ever stop looking for a savior? And is it not the fact that it's just innovating constantly to try and reflect the changes in technology?
Like I think the good thing about AI being an existential threat is like it's just the latest in the long line of existential threats. And that's why I think maybe as I get older, I'm just a little bit more jaded about how existential these threats are. I've just lived through so many panics, moral or otherwise, whether it was TiVo killing the 30-second spot still with us, whether it's, you know, I covered the spam panic of like the early 2000s, and they passed this onerous, quote unquote, onerous bill called the Can't Spam Act that was going to eradicate like email. Email's not dead, it's still with us. I can remember ad blocking and editing the 5,000th story on it at Digiday. And that existential threat didn't happen. Then GDPR, I could keep going on, you know what I mean? So I think, you know, publishers are, the good thing is they're sort of used to dealing with this quote unquote dynamic environment that always throws curveballs at them. You know, we used to run these GIFs on the homepage, and I would frequently find myself choosing the GIF of Charlie Brown trying to kick a football and Lucy pulling the ball away from Charlie and him going flying on, landing on his back, because it fits so many stories.
Yeah.
I think it's human nature to want to have just one thing that will change, be a game changer. And the reality is, in my view, media is in a back to basics moment where they're going to have to figure out how to do more with less. The zero interest rate era is over. It's going to get harder, and it was already hard. And I think it will benefit people who are creating real value to real audiences. I just believe that there is still an appetite for that kind of content, and it's going to get harder to engineer a lot of these media businesses. I'm not very, you know, bullish, I hate that word, but like on a lot of scaled models, particularly that are dependent on display advertising. That seems like a general fighting yesterday's war. But very niche models that can be, you know, solid businesses. Absolutely. I just don't think that you're going to build many like very large businesses. And that's okay.
It's okay. A niche always wins, I think, too. But in terms of existential threats and phrases that you often use, the pivot to video is one. And you did some research recently you can talk a bit about. But again, this is the publishing industry racing to make use of the newest and latest technology, but also to reflect sort of changing consumer patterns. And as we all know, the internet is becoming video based. Your research, I think, sort of.
Yeah. I think what we found is with the research that we did was there was this gap between where publishers assigned the strategic value of video and where video advertising was as a revenue source. And I think the major challenge for our advertisers that are trying to get out of the display ad cycle, I mean, a lot of the if there's a quote unquote pivot to video, it's a pivot away from display ads, right? And a lot of the video on publisher sites, again, it straddles the line between, is it video or is it advertising? Like, are we sure? Like, I mean, just because you license video, someone is coming to a web page to read an article and you're autoplaying a video, I don't know if that's like, that's to me just a new ad unit, and it's a more lucrative ad unit than a regular display unit. And so that, to me, the weakness in display is in large part driving a lot of this. And I think the big challenge for a lot of text-based content publishers is simply one of mode. Many people who are on their web pages are there to read an article, not to have to play a video. And so the only scale that many of these publishers can get is on platforms. It's hard enough to make money, and it's really difficult when you're cutting in YouTube and getting scale on those platforms. You're competing with some people with a lot of different economics. And that's a real challenge for quote unquote premium publishers is, I don't know about you, but like I didn't do TikTok. I just can't do TikTok, but like not out of national security concerns, just I know myself, I'll get addicted. But like, I got it. I'm into some like Pomeranian segment on like Instagram, man, they got like 3 hours gone with this like Pomeranians. And that comes out of professionally produced video. I mean, it's so, have you ever seen these doggy day at the spa videos on Instagram or something? There's a lot of them. And like, I'm like, you just create one thing of a cute puppy getting like it getting shampooed and stuff like this, and you can make a ton of money off, like they're selling the products and stuff. I'm like, man, the cost of creation is pretty low, and the thing is racking up millions and millions. It's got evergreen value. It's not like the value goes away of this puppy getting shampooed and its nails clipped and whatnot. I think that is a major challenge, right? And so, you know, publishers are dealing with how do they get into more higher value ad categories like video, but the problem ends up being to get scale, they're competing with the puppy getting shampooed. And then, you know, otherwise on their site, a lot of people aren't there to watch video.
What about all the publishers you talk to in terms of who you think is getting it right? And are there any issues around things like talent? Because if you're talking about video, it's a very different industry, although it's so closely aligned to traditional publishing as we know it. And but surely, I mean, if publishers could extend their brand across everything from print to web to CTV, but many of them often don't. So do you think what is holding up publishers in terms of developing as strong video propositions as their sort of written ones?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's a few things we found is, you know, there is an institutional memory of prior pivots to video, if you will, or video not working, you know, when it was like, okay, get a Brightcove player on the site. And there's a lot of sort of memories of things not working. It's pretty obvious that there's a lot of shift going on right now to video consumption. That's what advertisers want. And again, going back to the incentives and alignment challenge with publishers is they need to obviously satisfy what their users want, the audience wants, but they also need to satisfy what their advertisers want. And the market is signaling very clearly that advertisers want more video than they do like regular display. So in some ways, for publishers, it's how do we satisfy this quote unquote need for advertisers, which by the way benefits us tremendously, and we have to stay in business, with the fact that our audience is could be signaling to us, yeah, we're not into that video. So I think when models get more aligned, and that's where I don't think subscriptions are the be all and end all, but for instance, one publisher, we do these private dinners, one publisher was saying that their North Star, you know, to take an FT strategy sort of thing, is around subscriptions. And that North Star cascades into how they deal with their advertising business. So they stopped showing pre-rolls to subscribers. And the reason they stopped doing that is because the data showed that a subscriber who is engaged, particularly in video content, is far less likely to churn. So now they're starting to think about their audience member, as a customer, and as a customer who is not like, let's see how much they'll put up with, but serving the customer. And I think that is the major shift. And having that, it sounds very basic because it is basic, but a lot of publishers, the audience has come last because those publishers have basically been made for advertising. I don't know what else this, that's why I think it's very strange, because I mean, they make this for advertising. Like, that is what the model is. So that's why I think it's kind of funny, this panic about made for advertising, because it's like, oh, isn't that us? I'm against this. Wait, is that us? No.
That's so true.
I'm against lots of stuff until I find out that I'm in the category. And I'm like, well, I'm not against that.
You are. And hey, Brian.
It's like taxes, where people are like, we got to raise taxes on, like, you know, and then they're like, wait, no, I'm in that category. No, I'm against that.
Yeah.
No, new taxes.
Other new business models that everyone is trying out. Because as you say, display advertising, subscriptions, lots of different ways for publishers to make money, and has always been the case. But what about commerce?
Yeah, commerce is really interesting. Like
affiliate marketing forever, but the move to commerce for publishers, how were they doing it, you know?
Yeah, I mean, it's one that I actually want to do a commerce research report soon. You know, I did a podcast earlier this week with Chris Kimball, who he's a well-known, he's not like a chef, but he's a well-known like food and cooking personality, I guess, like going back to like PBS and America's Test Kitchen. And then he had this magazine, this amazing magazine, Cooks Illustrated, that turned the model on its head, because magazine business was a made for advertising business, and the subscriptions were basically given away. They just were about keeping the rate base up. And, you know, he turned it on its head. He stripped away all the photography. It was, you know, drawings and stuff. It was tightly curated. It was only 32 pages, and he sold subscriptions to it. Imagine. Anyway, he has this new site, not new, but he's been doing it for 6 years, Milk Street, that is a combination of content and commerce. And what was interesting about it is how inextricably entwined it has to be to work, like the content and the commerce, but that you're running almost like two different businesses. It was very reminiscent to me of actually B2B business models, where you're running a content operation and you're running an events business. And they're inextricably entwined, but you're really operating two different businesses. And so I think the biggest challenge of commerce is one of mode, is when someone is reading an article on a web page, oftentimes they're not in shopping mode unless it's very intent-based sort of thing, which is basically an SEO arbitrage play. And that's what most people, when they say, it's kind of like, when people were pivoting to video, they were really just pivoting to Facebook, because Facebook said they wanted video and they were in too deep with Facebook. If Facebook had said we wanted podcasts, they would have pivoted to podcasts, right? And I think in many cases it's similar here, in that the if there's a pivot to commerce, it's a pivot to SEO, because most publishers, what they're doing is they're taking their search authority, which is earned for a different reason, and trying to arbitrage it by sliding in some catalog content.
Look, let's talk a bit about, I mean, I guess I would say one of the big things about commerce publishers is that publishers are trusted. And the way I read generally, I trust that publisher, not trust the products I see on the page and that sort of thing, which leads me to the point about, I guess, about trust and what you're saying about trust in the brand, because there's a massive problem with lack of trust in advertising. You know, all the problems that have been going for a long time now, but the strength of publisher brands is enduring, and the strength of brands that have been around for decades or even months or years, you know, is really powerful for consumers. So what have you seen in terms of that changing the dynamics between publishers and advertisers, especially in light of the cookie one day going away and the programmatic marketplace becoming less efficient potentially?
There's a path for brand becoming more important, right, as a signal of trust and curation, if you will. And again, this is sort of back to basics to some degree. And because obviously with AI, it's just going to accelerate the amount of, I believe Peter Kafka had said on a podcast, we did a tsunami of crap. I think that's going to happen, right? And I think there'll be a lot of people who are going to be overwhelmed by that tsunami. A lot of publishers are going to get swept up in that tsunami of crap. But I think that if you do have a trusted brand, you got a way better shot. If you have a flimsy brand that has mostly been engineered and manufactured around trying to get in on the latest growth hack before measurement catches up. Yeah, you might get swept away, but also, I mean, I don't know, I'm a capitalist and I kind of think that, okay, but that's how the system heals itself. I don't think anyone deserves a media business by, I don't know, birthright or something. You got to go out there and fight every day. And that means actually proving that you deserve to exist. You don't inherit that. And I think that's just the reality today. Because if you want to coast on, oh, well, we've been around for 75 years, it's like, so? Like, why does that give you some sort of like inheritance? No, I mean, the system changes. There's new brands that start. And so if you're going to rest on thinking that like you deserve this, then that's a tough strategy, I think.
But back to strength about brand, and I would say if you've been around for 75 years, you're doing something right, and you've gone some sort of level of user trust or authority. So that's probably why that they could become the rest of the laurels, which obviously isn't the best strategy. But that level of consumer trust, and also that ability to back to the cookie gateway to build data on users, consumers who are happy to give stuff away to brands that they love and really trust than, you know, elsewhere. So are you seeing there's a lot of talk. I know you had the great Joe Root from Permative on your podcast recently. Yeah. Business, and hello, Joe. And what they spent a lot of time talking about, and you know, their mission is publishers first party data and how they can kind of regain power. Are you seeing that shift?
Yeah, I mean, I think we're seeing that shift across the overall economy, right, to direct to consumer models. And the reality of, like, as I said about publishing, is publishing gave up its distribution power. They had no control over its distribution. It was outsourced to platforms. And it's really difficult to run a business when you do not control distribution. It's just really difficult. And so overall, there's a return to smaller and more durable audiences. And then along with that, you have to understand your audience better. And that's the reality of this business. I don't think publishers on their own are going to be able to compete with the data sets that exist in technology companies. That's insane. But they need to know their audiences better in order to put things in front of them that the audience wants. And yes, some of those things are going to be advertisements. Some of those things are going to be, you know, smart ways to get people into the funnel in order to become paying customers. And then, you know, hopefully when publishers have enough paying customers, because I don't think it's just going to be subscriptions, but it's going to be part of it, they're going to start to have, I think there's going to be a spillover effect to how they end up approaching their advertising businesses. And maybe this is me being too hopeful, but I try to be a little optimistic, is that they'll start to be less adversarial of how much can we get away with. I joked, I went to one American publisher. It was right when Q4 started. I was like, uh-oh, Q4 started, because like there was only one line of text that was visible with all the ads that were coming in from the top, bottom, middle, and sides. And so when you start treating people as customers, that's better. And the first thing about a customer is you need to know more about your customer. I mean, it can get a little annoying. I had to go to a Starbucks. I hate Starbucks, but in Miami and the Starbucks next door. And, you know, they do that thing where they keep like saying your name. Like they were asking your name. I was like, there's no one in there. And then all of a sudden the other employees heard and started saying me. I was like, oh God, this is super American version of customer service. Like, why do I need these people? I don't know, say my name repeatedly. Thanks, Brian. Good morning, Brian. But the reality is every business wants to know their customer better. I don't think that's strange, but maybe it has been in publishing, but that's going from a wholesale to a retail mindset.
The way you keep talking about publishing gave away its distribution rights. And you also talked about earlier on about AI and potential pitfalls or opportunities, but we're seeing in the UK a move of publishers to start banning the likes of ChatGPT scraping their sites. So is that an existential problem, you think, that the publishers have, as you said, pay a lot of journalists a lot of money, or no, not just a lot of money, but they pay a lot of journalists for great content, and now it's just being stolen? How big a problem do you see? Not the problem of, you know, a torrent of crap coming along, but just in terms of the stealing of intellectual property.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's a typical sort of Silicon Valley approach is, you know, do something and then ask for permission later. And there's going to be a bunch of legal battles over this because it's another existential threat. And, you know, for the most politically connected publishers, I don't think that I'm not like super worried about them. I think the history of getting direct payments from these platforms, it seems more of a political exercise than anything. So I think the more politically connected the publishing company is, the better off they are. I don't think it's possible to, you know, shake down these tech companies in a way that is, you know, really equitable to the overall ecosystem, because that's just how it works. It's just, it's the people with the loudest voices and the most like power are the ones who are going to be compensated, not like the overall market. So I think it's like normal. I think most publishers, the reality is most publishers can't block these. I mean, they can block them, but it doesn't really matter. You know, like, let's be real here. Like a lot of what publishers do is like fungible. It's not like unique. Its value is like minimal. If you're just doing like another, like, you know, write up of like, I don't know, are they still doing write ups about like Harry and Meghan? Like, I don't know. Like, I mean, oh, block the, I'm sure like, you know, Sam Altman is like, oh no, I can't suck up that data. Wow. But look, if you're like Bloomberg or something like this, and you have unique data sets and all this, there's a lot of opportunities. And yeah, you're not going to give away, obviously Bloomberg or their terminal data doesn't give it away. You know, there's different gradations of value within like news organizations, but the average, you know, story like doesn't have as much value. It's kind of like paying people for the use of their own data. It's not as high as people think it is. So yeah, I think we'll see that kind of stuff, but it's mostly just negotiating, right?
Yeah, true.
Because I mean, it's like when you start blocking, so like robots.txt was always the thing where, you know, Google was saying, we're not scraping the internet. You just use robots.txt if you don't want us to crawl the pages. Put it on your entire website. We won't include it in the index. And the reality is the trade-off was such that nobody did that. But it also allowed Google to present itself as a universal search engine. More stuff is going behind paywalls that I don't think, you know, Google can really even claim that. And these LLMs will face that problem. I think the idea of a universal search experience is dead. You know, it's unfortunate to some degree, but that's a whole different podcast about the depth of the open web.
Yeah.
We're going to do another podcast actually right now.
Okay. Well, let's end up and talk about quickly about events, because you mentioned there's Stars Watch Out and events. I mean, like DigiDay, the summits were the crown jewels that I guess still are in the US, not the UK, because you very sadly stopped doing them. But events have always been so important to publishers, not just in B2B trade, but in consumer. Events have always been a key thing. So how are you seeing, especially all these kind of macro facts we're talking about, problems with publishers, how important are events and what are you seeing change in the appreciation of them?
Okay. What I'm seeing on the events is, and I use events broadly, I think a lot of publishers are moving into live activations. And it depends if they're lifestyle publishers, they're going to be festivals and things. But B2B has always been very events driven. And I think the pandemic has led to a resurgence of these events that's probably unsustainable. It reminds me of 2021 a little bit. I think that there's an events bubble. I heard it described as event season, like by someone. I was like, it sounded like the Taliban fighting season. You know, it's like when the MUDs stop, event season starts, you know, and you know, at the ad tech, you know, army rolls in to Key Biscayne, Florida. But yeah, I mean, look, I think what I'm seeing is a lot of companies are trying to get into areas where they don't compete with technology companies, and technology companies hate services, and events are a way to you know, compete in a new area that, you know, they're not scalable. There's all these kind of downsides to events and also to agency services, for instance. You know, obviously, you know that, like, it doesn't scale like technology, and that's fine. Like that's perfectly fine. I don't know. There's not a lot of these massive businesses to be built. And so, you know, it's okay. Like, embrace a services model, understand that your margins are going to be different, and that you're not going to, you know, have, I don't know, the nicest house in wherever in the Hamptons, but like you might still be somewhere in the Hamptons. I don't know. So it's fine. You'll be fine. Drive to the beach.
Okay. Well, that's a great idea. You'll be fine. Drive to the beach. That's probably
like it's okay.
Yeah, it's okay. It's always okay. Thank you so much for spending time with me.
Yeah, this is fun.
Thank you so much.
Awesome. Thank you, Justin.